Welcome to SEC Sports Roundtable, episode 165. We were part of a 3-2 game, recorded Wednesday, November 11th, 2015. Shane Bailey is joined by Nick Jones, Blair Smiley, and Britton Burton. Listen as they discuss Derrick Henry's performance and Alabama's statement win over LSU. Shane's down on his Wildcats. Vanderbilt lets one slip through their fingers. Mississippi State, Tennessee, and much more on tonight's SEC SRT. Welcome to SEC Sports Roundtable, episode 165. This is your host, Shane Bailey, back to talk a little SEC action. You know, we did a little pre-show prep here, and I don't think we talked 1 ounce of football on our pre-show here. So we won't go into that just yet on this podcast full throttle. I guess we're going to have to talk about it a little bit since the number two preseason team of the nation takes action Friday. but there was some football that occurred last week. And for those that were looking for our podcast, you know, Britton, I think you poised it correctly on Twitter. You know, we all have real jobs, and unfortunately, this one's not paying. So
we'll fix that someday.
Yeah, I might have paraphrased that a little bit, but we wish we could get it weekly, but it's just gotten really, really difficult. So we're going to continue to do our best. But, we did have some exciting football that did occur last week, so we're definitely going to talk about that. We're going to talk a little bit about this week's action. Week two of the college football playoff standings and rankings came out yesterday. I also think we're going to need to talk a little bit about the Missouri. I think it's a fiasco. If you start reading some of the reports that are coming out now after the fact about how all that was handled, but I'd like to get your all's take on some of that as we move into this this arena of sports talk for the next little bit. So let's get right into things and introduce the folks that are joining me tonight. From the left to right on my screen tonight, we've got Blair Smiley. Welcome, Blair.
Good to be back, Shane.
We're glad you've made it. Sounds like you've got some new technology figured out, so we're going to test that out tonight, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then Britton Burton, right off of the heels of a Kansas City Royals World Series victory, a city in chaos. Is that a good way to describe how that went?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, obviously, I'm not a huge Royals fan yet or anything, but it was pretty cool to see a city so behind their team. I did manage to make it out to the parade, mostly just to see what it was like to see 800,000 people in one place and have some pretty cool pictures from that. But I can't lie, when there was a choice between college football and the playoff run for the Royals, I pretty much chose college football every time.
Rightly so. I mean, you know, it as much as I love baseball, it can be extremely slow sometimes, especially when you're talking playoff baseball and it's not your team. I mean, can it get any slower in baseball? And then Nick Jones. Welcome, Nick.
It's good to be back, Shane.
Glad you could make it. So, guys, I we'll just go right into things. I understand that there were two powerhouses that came to battle last Saturday, and you know, one of them really, I think, imposed their will. And I know there's two folks on this podcast, especially, that are going to tell me their take on it. But guys, tell me what you thought about Saturday's performance.
Nick, you want to lead it off or you want me to?
You go ahead. I'll see what you got to say.
Okay. Well, so I guess I'm pretty glad that we weren't able to have a podcast last week, because I was as lacking in confidence heading into that game as I've been probably as an Alabama fan since, midway point of Saban's second year. I still don't really know if the offensive line is very good. And just coming into this game, I didn't expect Fournette to go crazy or anything. I thought the defense would play well, but I thought LSU's defense was as capable as Alabama's defense of shutting our offense down. And so I just really expected it to come down to, you know, which offensive line can make enough plays and which quarterback can make enough plays to win a tight game. So I really, you know, if I'd been betting, I would have taken LSU in the points. I mean, I really had no confidence heading into that game that we were going to win and especially be dominant the way that they were. And I knew the run defense in the front seven was great, so I didn't expect Fournette to go nuts, but I still thought he'd have like 30 carries for 100 yards. But the way that they just dominated every aspect of that game was amazing, and it was different. It had a different feel than basically every game in this matchup for the past 6-7 years, in that it, by the fourth quarter, you weren't just mentally exhausted, and it didn't have that knockdown, drag out, just physical war for four quarters feel to it, which makes me feel a little bit better about having to go to Mississippi State next week. It just wasn't what I expected. I thought the defense would play great, but I thought LSU would kind of match what Alabama's defense did, and I thought it'd be, you know, early on in the first quarter, or maybe even into the second quarter, it was scoreless, and we were about to kick a field goal, and you're like, okay, so it's going to be another like 12-9 game. And I really didn't think Alabama's offense was going to be able to make enough plays to win. I kind of trusted LSU's offense more, and I couldn't have been more wrong, and I couldn't be more glad that I was more wrong.
Yeah, you're right, Britton. I mean, I can't explain it. I wasn't that nervous going into the game, and it probably was just I tried not to think too much about the game last week. But there was a lot to be nervous about. You know, Alabama's played much better on the road than they have at home. That's very evident in how they played at Texas A&M and Georgia. Depends on what you think of those teams now, but those were big games at the time. And, you know, Jake Coker just hasn't played well at home. I mean, his best game was arguably at home, a game that Alabama lost against Ole Miss when he led the comeback to, you know, almost win the game. But the thing that stood out to me was, you know, just how I went back and watched it, because a lot of times I don't catch nearly as much as I would on TV in the stadium. But one of the things that struck me is, and I felt it in the stadium, like you're talking about, Britton, you know, 3-0, Alabama hits a field goal, you're like, all right, here we go. Alabama jumps out to a 10-0 lead, and then LSU answers, and you look at that field goal by Adam Griffith, a 55-yard field goal. I was having, you know, replays of the kick six, unfortunately, in my head. I could just see it coming. You know, it was the same thing that happened at the kick six. It was like we thought about it twice. We decided to send him out there anyway. It was 3 yards shorter than the kick six, and, you know, he nails it. And Saban and Bobby Williams look like geniuses because they sent him out there after calling a timeout. But after that, you know, you could say LSU did score again, and the Leonard Fournette kind of cleanup touchdown, you know, kind of made the game seem a lot closer on the scoreboard than it really was. But it was a dominating performance. The defense carried Alabama, and that's, I don't know if I've said it on this podcast or not, but I've been really frustrated with the fact that this season, you know, this sounds stupid, but could go to waste, as in Alabama may not get, you know, the postseason game that they want with such a dominating defense. Because last year, you know, let's be frank, the defense was the weakness. Alabama was pretty much winning most of the games that they played with offense. I mean, you saw that, and, you know, they tried to beat Ohio State with offense and got outscored. They almost got outscored by Auburn, took a fourth quarter drive against LSU in a very non-typical game in that rivalry last year. Blake Sims was racking up, you know, thousands of yards. Amari Cooper was having a great season. So, to me, you know, it was just an amazing performance by the defense. And one thing I wanted to throw out, I heard this on Feinbaum, and it sounded kind of stupid, and I kind of, you know, threw it over to the side at first, but they brought up the fact that LSU and Les Miles and Cam Cameron were very conservative with play calling. And, I mean, part of that is their system, right? I mean, you don't expect them to let Harris just drop back and pass, but there was a time in that stadium where I pretty much knew that Fournette wasn't going to gain any yards. I mean, on into the third quarter, you know, he had, what, 9 carries for 9 yards, and you're still going to pound him up the middle. I know he's a great running back, but, I mean, you know, we talk about sometimes forcing the issue and with the run game, and we're worried that Alabama doesn't do that enough sometimes, but I think LSU that kind of, you know, they shot themselves in the foot way too many times, because, you know, you look at Brandon Harris's stats, other than the two long passes, you know, he was pretty much, you know, had hardly any yards. So if LSU could bring that game back, I think that they would call the game a little differently, but no doubt Alabama's defense dominated the whole game.
Yeah, I think the Dylan Lee interception, the Dylan Lee interception at the very beginning of the half, because you're right, LSU kind of got some quick, cheap scores. You know, they bring the corner blitz on that one touchdown pass, which was surprising because Alabama doesn't have to blitz this year to get pressure, and especially against a quarterback like that. But the Dylan Lee interception right out of the gates, and you give it right back to the offense, and you give it to Derrick Henry, and LSU's back in the hole, and you know their bread and butter, it just isn't working. That was enormous. And real quick, Blair, before you go, Nick, you mentioned the Adam Griffith kick. If any Alabama fan tells you that they didn't have visions of Auburn kick sixes dancing in their heads as they're lining that kick up, they are flat out lying, because that was the scariest moment. Like, when they didn't have someone deep, when LSU didn't have someone deep on it, I already started standing up and clapping, because I was like, hey, at least it's not going to be a return for a touchdown.
Absolutely. I was just going to piggyback on what you guys were saying. I think the thing that I took away from the game was Alabama plays so well and is really in their strength when they get ahead first. And when they got out ahead, even though LSU, and that's what, you know, if you take the Ole Miss game, the mistakes early, you know, I mean, and I keep on harping on this, but they turned the ball over four times against Ole Miss, and, you know, on their side. And you think, you know, they get three touchdowns and a field goal out of those four turnovers, even though they had five for the whole game. You're just sitting there going, you know, Alabama usually squeezes out a couple more field goals, doesn't allow a team to actually score touchdowns. And Alabama in that game had to revert to last year's offense and kind of throwing it around the yard, not doing what they do and grinding out with Henry and all that kind of stuff. When they get a lead early, even if it's 10 points, they can really lean on playing to their defense, you know, and doing that stuff. And I think that's what it was. And I think LSU, I think that's their biggest problem was that they didn't want Harris to make a mistake in the first half. And even though that first play of the second half was a very simple rollout, I think they were going to be more attacking in that second. I think they wanted to kind of get the feel of the game, and I think that just simple rollout where he throws a pick, and that was the ball game. I mean, it totally changed everything. And so, you know, and the stat that I took away from it was the last drive, I think they got the ball back a little less than 8 minutes left and completely grinded it down. And I think Derrick Henry had 70-something yards, which was the most yards given up by an individual running back against LSU all year, and he did it on that one drive, was the very last drive. And, you know, it ends up with 200 plus and three touchdowns. I mean, huge performance.
Yeah.
It's dominant of full performances you've seen all year.
And that last drive, it's kind of easy to forget, you know, in the glow of the victory. But when Henry fumbles that ball and then Fournette does run it in, I mean, again, if an Alabama fan is telling you they weren't nervous there, I mean, because that's a classic college football thing. You know, you've dominated a game, and you have that one miscue that all of a sudden makes it a game. And we've seen that happen time and time again in college football, where all of a sudden the team that's played terrible all night just finds a way to win, and weird stuff happens because it's college football.
And that's LSU. And I mean, that's LSU's MO for a lot of games. So.
Sure, that's Les Miles. And, you know, I think you're thinking as an Alabama guy, you're thinking, okay, just get two first downs. Just get one first down. Get us some room to punt it and trust the defense, and we still feel okay. And then you look up and there's zeros on the clock, and you're like, was that just a nine-minute drive where Derrick Henry had seven straight or whatever, however many carries? I mean, it was crazy. Just an amazing way to end it.
And for an old guy like me that went to the Predators game and basically shut down Twitter and everything else so I could come back and watch the game, you know, about 1:30 in the morning when I'm you know, fighting to stay awake. I'm like, this is pretty anticlimactic, but I just watched 7 minutes just go by, and this is going to end in a complete dud. Here I am, 2 a.m. It's like, it sucked. I was like, I thought it was going to be better than this. But
well, I think that's a good place to kind of to switch gears just a little bit, because at this point, I think this game's been hashed out, and most people have a really good understanding of both sides of it. You know, Derrick Henry, we all knew how good a performance he could do. I mean, to be on that stage and do what he did, it really changed the whole landscape of the Heisman talk. And so that's something interesting. And you mentioned anticlimactic, and here I am texting you at the end of the Ole Miss Arkansas game, and you're going, I'm at the Predators game. It's like, well, I'm not going to ruin that one for you, especially I know how much you love Ole Miss. And so what a wild finish to that game.
That was not anticlimactic.
That was the opposode of anticlimactic.
I mean, could y'all believe that game? Britton, that was talking about
unbelievable.
Britton, that's the second good segue we've had in the last couple of times you've been on here. We're starting to get this stuff together.
We're getting good at this.
But I mean, I mean, guys, I went back and I was kind of going in between that and the Tennessee game, but before I took off, but you know, I just went back and looked. I'm like, where's this defense that Ole Miss? They got Tony Connor back. And here's Brandon Allen. I mean, he's literally just throwing it all over the field on them. Like,
all over.
That's
the field.
And that's the thing that was really surprising to me. And I know that Arkansas, you don't want to play them, no matter if they were 1-3 at the beginning of the year, just because they're so big, they're so heavy, they're going to pound you. And if Brandon Allen gets hot, he can burn you with all this play action, because you have to commit so many guys to stop the run, and they jumble everything up. But I was really, really shocked, and really Ole Miss's offense was about as fluid as it's been. And I'll tell you what, man, Laquon Treadwell is just an absolute beast.
He's good.
I mean, how that guy doesn't get targeted 20 times a game, I have no earthly idea. Yeah, that's what I was really shocked by was, it was one of those classic Saturdays where defense just went out the window and it just became this big, sling fest. And what a crazy ending.
Nick, what do you got on that?
I mean, I was sitting there watching it before we had to go into the game, and unfortunately I didn't, catch everything live that happened at the end. But one of the things that
– the good news about this game is – you got to see it 100 times afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. There was plenty of highlights to be had. But like Blair was saying, with defense going out the window, it was just amazing to me. Not that necessarily, I mean, obviously that Ole Miss gave up 53 points, but just sitting there watching Ole Miss score and Arkansas answer right back. I mean, that was one of the craziest things. I mean, the points were equal in every single quarter, and then obviously Arkansas, squeaks it out in overtime. And then also, one of the things that was strange to me, I went back and looked at the stats, is neither team had a turnover, and there was only 6 penalties combined in an overtime game like that. And of course, one of them made the difference in the game. But, if I would have looked, if you would have told me that Chad Kelly wasn't going to throw any interceptions and Brandon Allen was, not going to have any turnovers, I would have probably looked at you, crossways. But it kind of put out the window what every SEC fan, probably except for Ole Miss, was hoping for, in the fact that, the two top teams, really Alabama, controls their own destiny. So that was good, and you got a pretty good applause in Bryant Denny, before the game started, so that was fun.
Oh, yeah. And how about Bielema just having the guts to go for two.
To go for it twice.
And then to do it twice, to get that. And part of you, he's the kind of guy that, I could just sit him, I could just see him on the sidelines basically going, okay, we just converted 4th-and-25. The whole freaking football gods are on this sideline, so we're going to just do whatever the heck we got to do to get out of here.
He's on a heater. Got to ride it.
And to run the guy, I mean, to run a quarterback around the edge, I thought was, you know, I mean, you sit there and think about Ole Miss's defensive front and those guys, and, you know, it was just, I just thought it was a gutsy call, and, you know, it was just, you know, it was a pretty shocking performance for me for a team that everybody's talked about them being kind of Jekyll and Hyde, and you didn't know which one was going to show up, but you thought, hey, here's a team that still – who truly did have everything to play for, and still had everything in front of them, you know, and it just kind of goes to show you got to play every game.
I mean, Arkansas comes off of, what, a 4-overtime victory 2 weeks ago to this one. And what was surprising for me, and Nick, you said a little bit of it, it was like the last team to score is going to win. And it was a matter of them trading punches. One would score, then the other would score. And finally, I guess it was somewhere in midway through the third quarter, almost to the fourth quarter, all of a sudden you had a change of possession without a score. And it's like, all right, here's – and Ole Miss did that. And it's like Arkansas now has the opportunity to take advantage of this. And then all of a sudden they turned the ball over on downs, and – I don't think it was three and out, but they weren't able to score. And so there were a couple of punts, and it's like, all right, so when's and then the back of my mind's going, all right, when's Kelly going to throw an interception to give Arkansas the lead for good on this? And that never happened. And so that was the craziness about this game, is not only the back and forth, but you were expecting – I wasn't expecting a backwards lateral of 20 yards to go in for a, you know, fourth and 25, but I was expecting something crazy to happen the way it kept going back and forth. It's like – something's going to have to happen. You always hear the bend don't break. Something was going to break for somebody on one side of these teams to put them ahead, and it never really happened except for the crazy play at the end. It was a lot of fun to watch, especially since I didn't have a dog in the hunt on either side. So that was enjoyable.
It's been a great year for, you know, for why we love college football, from the Michigan State game to this game, to the Miami Duke game. You know, there have been a number, seemingly a lot, involving special teams, a number of games.
Michigan State twice.
Yeah, I mean, the way Michigan State lost, you know, I mean, this is why we're hopeless addicts, right? Because it's just, it doesn't even have to be Alabama. It doesn't have to be the SEC. I mean, when crazy stuff like this happens, it's like, God, I love college football. So, on that 4th and 25, you know, it's rare when you actually have a moment where you're like, you know, there's a 1 in a million chance that something's going to happen here, but it's college football, so let's just watch, let's hope. And then it happens, and it's unbelievable. And I wanted to ask y'all, because I was debating this with my Arkansas buddy Jimmy, who's been on here. I think that 4th and 25 play was designed. Obviously the way it went down, you can't really draw that up. But I think it was supposed to be a short throw that Henry just throws back, and it's like, let's see what happens. Jimmy thinks that he just did that as being an aware player, not wanting the play to be dead. Do y'all think it was designed?
I think it was completely aware player. If you watch it and they roll back over, he's scanning the whole field, and really the only option that he had, and I saw an angle from like the field goal post, and so you could tell he was looking, and he had three other receivers in the route. But for that second, because he doesn't have a strong arm, when he throws that ball, it takes so long to get from one side to the other. The kid for Ole Miss had a chance to kind of break on it because he was wide open, and probably if he could get the ball to him, had a chance to kind of maybe shaking, but once by the time the kid got on him, but the ability to throw that ball backwards and for three people to jump in the air and it not touch, and then the ball to just have that thud bounce and, you know, and just bounce straight up to Alex Collins is just, I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's like, holy cow. Because I didn't get to see it, I went back, and I mean, I kind of knew about it. And when I went back to see it, when they replayed the game, I kind of just taped it so I could watch that overtime. And it was just amazing, the shots of you know, when they got to 4th and 25, and how Kelly and all the people on Ole Miss were all kind of basically already celebrating, and they're all smiles and everything, just to see how everything just changes in a moment. Mm-hmm. Is just, you know, just a shock to your system.
Well, Britton, I don't think they, I mean, sat down and schemed out this play, but now I do believe that they work on the fact that it's the end of the game kind of situation. You're stuck. What are your options? You know, I do think they drill that. And if you're aware and are able to go back to what you've practiced, you can bring that out to some degree. But I don't think they actually practiced that exact play. But I do think they put themselves in situations to say, all right, it's the end of the game. You're down. You got to throw a Hail Mary kind of thing. What are some of our options we can do with this? And they drill that. But I don't think they schemed out a play like that. That's my
opinion. It seemed weird to me because they had, I think, rips to one side, and it looked like they just ran them off. And it looked like the idea was, let's get 4 or 5 defenders to just go with them. And then you drag Henry on like a 15-yard all the way across the field drag type play. It's obviously not going to pick up 25 yards. So to me, it seemed like, I don't know that they did or not. And obviously the result of it, you know, there's no way you draw that up. But it seemed like it was, let's draw everyone but the 3 pass rushers away, throw it to Henry 15 yards downfield, and just tell him to chuck it back where we've got a quarterback, a running back, and 5 offensive linemen, and see what happens. That is honestly what went through my head when I saw it happen. And I could, y'all might be right. It may have just been he just threw it up because he was being a smart player. But
I think they're
saying,
the
first thing that went through my head was that it was designed.
I think they're saying it's 4th and 25. If we can get 15 through the air and get another 10 afterwards, that's our only hope. We're not going to throw it in the air 25 and make the first down.
Yeah.
But now we will switch gears again and go from, you know, 105 point total score to the opposite end of that.
And I think I know what game you're going to talk about.
And I'll tell you what, this Vanderbilt program is snake bit. They had this game, and I mean, that defense had played a tremendous game all the way up into that last drive that they had that horrible punt and gave Florida pretty decent field position, but they just, that was unbelievable how the Vanderbilt's defense held Florida to in check that whole entire game and let them do that at the end. That was just I hated that for them, but because I wanted to see Florida lose, and you know, I don't have any love lost for Vanderbilt. So you know, it was I was kind of rooting for the guys in black to pull that win out, but that was just, all you can say is wow.
Yeah, it was. I totally agree that they're, it seems like they're snake bitten, because they even had the whole, I mean, the drama of the Florida kicker in that second half was palpable, you know, because it's like Vanderbilt really has a chance here, because the one scholarship kicker that is capable for Florida is hurt, and is so hurt that he's kind of been terrible when he's had opportunities this year. What was his long, like 32 coming into the game or something? And they've got this walk-on who, kind of like Tennessee several years ago, some guy from Frat Row walks on, and because they're that desperate, and he misses the extra point, which is why it's not a tie game to begin with. And you're like, okay, Florida clearly didn't come to play. They're not ready, you know, early time, not up for the opponent. The crowd's not into it. This is totally going to come down to a field goal, and no one knows whether or not Florida actually has a kick with it to make a field goal. And then he makes an amazing kick, you know, his best kick of his career at Florida. Was for as terrible as a game as it was, and it had all the eyeballs because it's 11 o'clock and it's kind of the only game worth watching in the SEC. It was kind of drama filled down the stretch because of that whole kicker dynamic.
Yeah, well, and Florida with that win, basically they secured the East. I mean, we're still a couple of weeks away with football, a lot of football left on the field, and Florida's got it in the bag.
Yeah, and you know, Coach McElwain said in his post-game presser, and you know, this is typical. I mean, you can't say this, and it's true now that you won the game, but he kind of referred to, you know, back when he was at Alabama when they played Tennessee and, you know, had to have a field goal block to win it. And he said, you know, the classic line, well, you're in a championship year, you're going to have, you know, games like this where you have to grind it out.
Because it is, a championship year. Yeah, I remember. Because it is a championship year.
Yeah, that's what he said, because we've clinched. But
whatever.
But, you know, was that a grind-out game? I mean, obviously it was a grind-out game, but in the sense that, you know, Vandy performed, I didn't get to see it. Was it the point that Vandy just stuck it out and did so well, or was it just Florida played terribly? Because I think in that Alabama-Tennessee game, it was kind of a mix, and Alabama had to survive. But it's a little bit different playing Vandy, because that was a pretty decent Tennessee team.
Vandy's defense is legit.
Yeah.
Florida might have been a little flat because it was Vanderbilt, but realistically, Vanderbilt was playing a good defensive game. It wasn't anything that I don't think Florida miscues. It was Vanderbilt's defense in a lot of that situation that made Florida so inept at that point. Vanderbilt just doesn't have an offense to save their
life. Yeah, that's the thing, Shane. Like, I'm with you that Vanderbilt's defense, if you're not an SEC fan, you would have no clue that Vanderbilt actually has a really solid defense. But they're offensively, they are so bad. So it's still kind of hard for me to say that Florida just didn't play terrible. And now, you know, part of it is the quarterback thing going on with them. I think they've got a bit of an offensive identity crisis because McElwain is a pro-style guy, drop-back, traditional quarterback guy, and Treyon Harris just is not that at all. But still, to be that inept when you know Vanderbilt literally cannot throw the ball. I mean, it's remarkable to me that a college offense is that incapable of passing, of the forward pass, you know, in major college football. You know they've got to run it, and you're able to stop it for the most part other than that one long run. I mean, it's constant three and outs, or maybe they get a first down and then punt. For Florida's offense to not be able to get something going eventually at some point, you know, they were flat. They just beat Georgia, killed Georgia. You know, that happens in college football, but that's a disappointing performance, and it's got to damage your confidence going forward as a Florida fan, feeling like, you know, hey, we've got one shot at whoever comes out of the West, we can do it. And I don't know. After that, it's hard for me to buy into you beating a good team that's going to come out of the West.
So, Britt, you probably don't ever remember watching Sly Kroon's West Coast offense at Mississippi State? Okay.
That's what it looked like.
It's kind of like watching a barge.
Half a yard in a cloud of dust.
That's right.
Is that because you got tackled back there?
Yeah. Remember, we were part of the 3-2 ball game at one time. So.
Well, I do think this saved, I mean, win or lose on this game, I think that all the talk that around Nashville over the last couple of weeks is Derek Mason going to be looking for a new job. I think that conversation's been squelched by how well this defense has performed. I think they're a good offensive coordinator away from being a decent team again.
To be honest with you, Shane, I don't know if it's necessarily the offensive coordinator, because if you talk to football people, you know, the guy that got's a good guy. I just think they just don't have players. I mean, they've got a – they kind of find a quarterback that's not going to throw three picks a game. I mean, you know, they ripped the ridge. I know the kid was hurt, and he's probably going to come back this week, and you just got to go with Shermer. But, you know, they 2 weeks ago, they're in a ball game, and, you know, they play the Shermer kid two possessions and then bring in the other kid, and, you know, he throws the pick that he's been throwing 11 times earlier this year. And I think that's the problem, is that you can't, with that defense, if you could just eliminate turnovers, you're going to screw around and have a chance to win a couple of ball games. And I think they had enough people messed up that they just got to get some horses on that side of the ball.
What if they try to switch and just do the Navy offense, the triple option? I mean,
I, for real though, that, like, if there's any team in the country that needs to do some kind of gimmicky offense, whether it's triple option or it's five wides all game, literally never run the, you know, I mean, they, Vanderbilt has to do something like that. They're just not going to win consistently trying to do what the rest of the SEC does.
I thought they should take all five offensive linemen and line them out wide and bring all the special players, all your specialists, and just bring them in to block and just completely change it up and see if you could do come up with any better option.
At least confuse them, maybe.
Seriously, because I was like, I'm pretty sure that these three wide receivers, those two running backs could block better for the quarterback, and maybe the 300-pounder could catch an 8-yard out. I don't know. But
the 8-yard out's got to get 8 yards and out.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe more of a stop route type of guy.
Let's see, what else? I didn't even put a lot of information. I didn't put a lot of time into this Tennessee-South Carolina game. I looked at one point, and it's like I forgot what the score was, but Tennessee was like way ahead on and also,
2 touchdowns, 17-3.
That's a
17-point lead.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh gosh, you know, I was so hopeful for South Carolina off of their performance last week. Was it against A&M?
Yeah, I mean, and I watch most of this because my 5-year-old likes Tennessee and he wants to watch them, and so
you've got to do something about that.
I've given in to that.
You've got to do something about that.
You don't have to tell me I'm a horrible parent. I already know I am, so it's okay.
You're better than that.
But the, you know, it was playing out like all of their games in the first four, you know, the three early games that they lost.
Yeah.
You know, and the Darrell Adams kid, you know, just, you know, you feel everybody closing in on you. You got enough yardage for, you know, a field goal to at least tie this thing, and they come in there and make a strip. And, you know, Butch could sell that all he wants to, but, you know, for them, for Josh Dobbs to, in that offense, to play as poorly as they did in the second half and not be able to move on a defense that is pretty terrible, it's got to be pretty disappointing, and it's a good thing that they've got the non-existent programs for the rest of the year.
Well, it was,
they're going to struggle against Vanderbilt moving the ball.
It was their letdown game after such a tough performance, you know, the week prior against Kentucky. I don't even go there.
Yeah. We want to. You don't even want to get on. Is Kentucky even a topic tonight?
Basketball. Well, let's talk basketball. Britain was on me. Was it 2 weeks ago when we were last on? Why am I so down on the Kentucky Wildcats? Well, you know, the last 2 weeks is a good indication as to how good this team's performing.
Are you gonna start Drew Barker?
I am not gonna go down this rat hole. The receivers just have to catch a blasted ball. I mean, how many times can you get hit in the numbers and drop it?
I don't know.
It's ridiculous.
It's amazing how quickly it's gone south for Kentucky, because 5 games into the season, you're like, you know, Kentucky could win the East. They could win the East, and it's, I mean, they look as bad as they've looked in a decade.
I saw statistics where Tolles is, what, one touchdown and 6 interceptions in the last 4 games? So, and, like, I mean, he's under 50% in those games. I mean, he's had, like, I mean, what did he have the other night? I mean, he was 8 for 24, 26 or something. I mean, he's like 33% completion. Yeah. It's awful, man.
All right, we're done talking about Kentucky. We've got basketball, and if you want to talk basketball, we can do that, but I don't think we're ready to do that either.
All right.
You know, at least Kentucky's not alone. You know, where's A&M disappeared to?
Whoa, tell me about it. Yeah. Kyler Murray finally lost a game. It's quarterback, huh?
They're the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde of college football. It's you just never know what you're going to get from them, and there's no excuse for them to be this bad.
Well, I think the Murray kid figured out that he's not Johnny Manziel. And that in the SEC, he can't just run around like a little, you know, I mean, because he just got destroyed through four picks, and bad picks, man. So yeah, I mean, that was surprising, and for you wondered if Auburn would ever show up, you know, with the you thought if they were going to come back from the dead, but I mean, I tell you what, they played a good game, and defensively, that was a pretty bad performance, man.
Well, we really find out if they come back from the dead looking ahead to this week. I mean, you know, Georgia's got their confidence back after getting to play Kentucky. So, you know, they face off. And the SEC thinks this is going to be a tremendous matchup because they've made it their 11 o'clock Central game.
It is on CBS, though.
CBS has got another doubleheader, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Even still, it's still an 11 o'clock game, so they've got they put no merit into this game. And that's, I mean, this is Georgia Auburn. When Auburn had that tremendous run a couple years ago, this game right here is, you know, that was it a reception late against Georgia? You know, that sealed that victory and put Georgia, you know, kind of put the nail in the coffin for them. So, I mean, you know, this has got some merit of a good game, at least from a matchup standpoint, but you know, to be an 11 o'clock kickoff, it's just, they don't think so.
Well, I think we've talked a little bit about it, and this is the third week in a row where Auburn started to look like Auburn again. And this was even with Jeremy Johnson starting. And I can't pretend that I saw a lot of this game because it was on at the same time as the Alabama game. But, you know, when Auburn can get that running game going, and when they can get you second and four and or pick up a first down and they run the same play over, you know, again, which is what Malzahn loves to do, get the tempo going, and they can get the quarterback run going a little bit, which it's nothing now compared to what it was with Nick Marshall. You know, they can kind of get right, and they just it was so weird the first 6-7 games of the season to see them be so inept offensively, and it's not like they're a juggernaut now, but I think you're finally starting to see, okay, this is kind of at least a semblance of what we expected coming into the season, and with Carl Lawson back on defense, you know, they're not world beaters by any means, but two games in a row where they've at least looked better. They've at least looked capable. And so I think that's kind of what you're seeing. And, you know, I love to make fun of Malzahn as much as anyone, but the hallmark of a good coach, especially at this level, is that you improve throughout the year, and they appear to be doing that. Now, I still think they're going to wind up a 6 or 7 win team, but this is, you know, you have to at least be happy with the direction of the team if you're an Auburn fan. And, you know, with Georgia's quarterback situation and just whole team situation, I don't think you're going into this game thinking, oh, man, there's no way we can beat Georgia.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, guys, I mean, I think you said it right. I think Carl Lawson, what he does is he actually gives all those other guys on the defensive line more confidence. But the thing that you're seeing, man, is Javon Robinson is starting to live up to a little bit of the hype that he had. He's a very tough runner. And they can say all they want to about Peyton Barber. At the beginning of the year, the only reason he had a bunch of yards is because he was the only one doing anything. And he's not a very good running back. And Javon Robinson is a kid that runs hard. He's very difficult to tackle. And if he starts getting that mojo going, he started to get that in the Ole Miss game, if you watch, towards the end. And they really couldn't capitalize on it. But he's starting to play well, and I think that helps them out when they can run the football.
Yeah, totally agree.
So as we look to this week's matchups, and I'll stay with the 11 o'clock kickoff, can South Carolina play spoiler to Florida's? I know that Florida's locked up the East, but, you know, can they come in and throw another loss on Florida's side? Because potentially you could really take them out of any consideration for a major bowl game with a loss against South Carolina and Florida State still on their schedule in two more weeks.
Is that game in South Carolina?
It is. Yep.
Yeah. I think they could give them a little bit of a run for their money, especially with Florida could possibly, you take a look that, hey, they had their bad game and they'll kind of regroup, but they could kind of take a little bit of a deep breath because they've got the East wrapped up. South Carolina's playing hard for Elliott, and if they can get some good quarterback play, they're running the ball more than Spurrier would, you know, and so, and their defense is coming along. It's still not very good, but Florida's offense is not going to really test that. So, I think they can make it close, and being in South Carolina, you know, it could get tight, but I think Florida will end up winning it.
Yeah, I didn't know. You know, I mean, South Carolina's played tough game, and they've had tough losses the last 2 weeks. You know, try to come back against Tennessee and then play an A&M tough 2 weeks ago. You know, I don't know if they continue that, and they're building momentum off of that, because earlier in the season they were losing bad. You know, now at least they're losing and getting into some tough ball games. If they could build off of that and sneak that would make me happy. I'm gonna root for South Carolina to do that, and then Florida State to give them another loss. You know, that would make me happy.
There you go.
But things don't always happen the way I want them to. That's why we're not talking about Kentucky football right now. I don't think there's any reason to talk about the Tennessee game this week against North Texas. We can talk about your boys, and I can talk to all three of you, right?
That's right. You got all the experts on.
Well, Mississippi State's hosting Alabama. So your dogs have a chance?
This is my prediction. My prediction is that Natty Light will skyrocket in Starkville. I'm just, guys, this is what's actually pretty interesting. I don't really have a lot of faith that State's going to win because, you know, I think last year, if you look at last year's game, it was, even though Alabama didn't have as good of a defense, State was a running football team last year. And the one thing that Alabama does this year is they stop the run, and we can't run the ball. And so if we literally run it more than zero times, I'll probably be angry. because we, for some reason or not, I mean, Dax picked it up a little bit, and really the only successful runs we've had has been when we just got the, you know, we've got the extra man advantage and Dak runs the dive or runs, you know, quarterback draws or whatever. But, you know, the one thing that they can do is they can throw the football. And this is a game that I think Dak's been waiting for. I think they'll actually and as good as Alabama's defense is and as good as their secondary has, I guess, kind of matured throughout the year, if there's one place that you can possibly beat Alabama, it's just throwing the ball on them if you can get enough time. And I think they got the athletes to kind of play that. Now, the kicker's going to be, you know, when Mississippi State plays in Starkville and you get Alabama playing in Starkville, you know, State will play them tight for 2.5 quarters, and then they get basically a 10-point lead in the late third quarter, and they just grind it out. And it ends up being a semi-close game, but it was really never close. And so I'm interested to see how that works. I mean, the interesting thing, State scores, I think I saw a statistic that they score 75% of the time in the red zone touchdowns on offense. And they allow 32% on defense. They're the only team in the SEC that's in the top four in offensive and defensive efficiency. So, and another stat is that we have not allowed a fourth quarter touchdown all year, which is a pretty remarkable stat, and especially in the last 4 weeks when we've had a lot of garbage time because we've been up, that we've not allowed a score. So, the thing I always worried about Alabama is you always kind of played it close. They had a, you know, 3-6, 7-point lead, and they end up scoring the touchdown in the fourth quarter to kind of pull away. And so I'm interested to see how that actually works out. But, you know, if Coker has a bad game or something, or what – the thing that you got to do with Henry is when – the only way that you can slow that dude down is you got to hit him before he starts running. And if he gets to the line and can actually get through that first level – he is so dangerous. And so I think State's going to – I think they'll give up some plays, and I think they'll grind it out. But I still think it's going to be, you know, like a 24-13 game or something is kind of one of those things. But I'll be interested to see. I think State's matured, and I think Dak being there, I would let him throw it 60 times. I'm not kidding you at all. I would not even try to run it. But that's just me. So we'll see what happens. It will be a record crowd. They will have a new record crowd after this weekend. So,
well, yeah, so I fully expect this game to just be gross for Alabama and for Alabama fans. I think that it's always coming off this LSU game, it's tough to go play Mississippi State. This, I mentioned it earlier, I think this year is a little bit different because it just wasn't the same, you know, war for four quarters with LSU. So I don't know if there's going to be that fatigue and beat-up factor quite as much. But, you know, you hear Gary Danielson say it every time during an Alabama game, to beat Alabama you have to have elite quarterback play. And Dak is the one quarterback in the conference this year who can provide that. So I think that, you know, he'll make some plays, he'll keep it close. The thing that kind of gives you confidence, I guess, as an Alabama fan is that Blair mentioned that they just can't run the ball. And even against teams that can run the ball this year, Alabama is keeping two high safeties and controlling the line of scrimmage with their four down. And so you would anticipate against a team that is struggling to run the ball this year that they'll certainly be able to do that. They're also leading the conference in sacks, so they can get pressure with four. So I think you're going to see a lot of two high safeties, not letting them beat you over the top, not letting that monster to run you, Wilson, you know, be singled up and catch deep balls all day on you. And I just think it's even as good as Dak is, it's going to be hard for him to make the big play. They're going to force you to, you know, have 10, 12 play drives, and that's just really hard to do against a defense of this quality. So yeah, I think the way that Mississippi State wins is Dak Prescott going nuts and the Alabama offense or special teams doing what they've done a couple of times this year, which is shoot themselves in the foot with penalties and turnovers. But I anticipate an Alabama win, but I think that I'm going to be sick to my stomach by the time the game's over.
Yeah, and not to belabor a point, guys, but I think you're right. You know, the key to winning for Mississippi State is definitely through the air. But one thing that jumps out to me, and I really hadn't thought about this, is, you know, if Alabama survives this game, the biggest weakness that we believed Alabama had coming into the year, the secondary's position, you know, I mean, Auburn is still a very, you know, big-time game, especially at Auburn, but I don't think Auburn's going to beat Alabama through the air. So, you know, if you walk away with a victory out of Starkville in a reasonable manner, you can go ahead and say that Alabama's secondary, safeties and corners, you know, pretty much stepped up to what they needed to do to put Alabama in winnable situations outside of the Ole Miss game. So, you know, the way Dak is playing right now scares me. I think he's very underrated, maybe not by the, you know, the coaches and the players, but nobody's talking about Dak the way that they were last year, and, you know, partially that's because Mississippi State isn't the number one team in the nation right now, but the offense is just, you know, outside of not having a run game, the pass offense is very much improved, and Dak's just got that, you know, look to him this year. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see him because I haven't, you know, been able to watch too many Mississippi State games. But, you know, like Blair's been telling us the past couple weeks, you know, he's playing out of his mind, and that's why Mississippi State is, you know, just go ahead and rub it in. But here, I'll go ahead and do it too. Not going to finish last in the SEC West. So.
That's right. But, you know, I think the piggyback on that, guys, is, you know, the biggest thing if you're a Mississippi State fan, especially early in Dan Mullen's tenure, and really last year was one of those cases. When we played Alabama, we had all the pressure on us. We were the number one team. We had been rolling 5 weeks in. We had really struggled at Kentucky. We had, you know, really struggled a couple of games leading into that, and we played really tight. And the first half, if you remember that last year, we were tight. And then all of a sudden, we kind of opened it up in the second half. And that's been a big theme this week is, you know, they're playing with house money. They've got nothing to lose. And if Mullen and this is the thing to look for early in the first quarter, if they are not conservative on offense, you better watch out, because if Mullen actually just goes aggressive and does aggressive play calling, then that lets me know that he's not playing this thing conservative tight and trying to get it into a fourth quarter. He's just going to let it all hang out, and that's what I'm excited about. And the thing about Dak, he's one passing touchdown and two running touchdowns away from the 60-40 club, which is ridiculous, 60 throwing and 40 running in a career, which is just astronomical to even think about. So I'm just going to be interested. I'm going to be really excited to watch the game. I don't really have a lot of expectations. But I think it is as good of an opportunity as State has ever had to get him outside of John Parker Wilson quarterbacking. So,
well, here's my two cents. I think that there's a potential that after this game, somebody can solidify some Heisman talk, whether it's Dak Prescott coming onto the scene and really stealing the show and being able to put himself back into that conversation, or Derrick Henry putting his foot down and saying, now, guys, I did it to LSU, I've done it to Mississippi State and Dak Prescott, you guys need to pay attention to me. I think that's one of the storylines that I haven't heard any conversation about yet, but I think that can be out there as that game progresses, especially as we see that game unfold.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, if y'all go and look at Dak Prescott's stats through today compared to last year, he's got more rushing yards last year, but he's tied. I mean, it's not by a ton, but it's just amazing, kind of the similar season and similar stats that he's having, and it's just that he hasn't made those huge wow plays. He's just made the consistent play all year. I mean, having 24 touchdowns and one interception, and the interception was, against Kentucky, and he admitted that it was just a dumb throw. But it's just pretty interesting how it'll be.
I think it was a strong defense.
Yeah, I do. I think it was a good play by the kid, though, for real. But while we're on the Heisman talk, what are y'all's thoughts on this? And I don't want to take too much time on it, but, basically – I don't understand, like, on a running back isn't like a quarterback, where the quarterback, he can kind of control. So, like, if a quarterback's not having a good game, he could still manage it and kind of grind it out. If a running back, Leonard Fournette, when I leave that game on Saturday, I leave that game going, Alabama's defense is just ridiculous. I didn't leave the game basically saying, well, Leonard Fournette's a terrible running back. And
right.
So to think that he's basically just completely out of the Heisman, I think Henry kind of vaulted into serious contention in the race, but I think Fournette is still there. If he comes back and actually, plays, it just kind of shows you what Alabama defense has. But I think with a running back, you can't discount it as much as you can a quarterback who has the ball in his hands and can kind of manage his way out of it. If you don't have anybody that can block, and you're getting hit 5 yards in the backfield, there's nothing you can do about it as a running back. There's no way for you to actually kind of get around that. And so I'll be interested to see how that affects him going forward. But it was definitely a dominating performance for
no,
sure.
No, I don't think Fournette's out of the conversation. But what I do think is that if Henry continues to have these type of performances.
Yes.
And putting up 175, 200 yards, 2 and 3 touchdowns these next 3 weeks. You got Mississippi State. Who do you guys have the week after that? A nobody. And then Auburn, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, you do that in the last 3 weeks against Mississippi State and then especially Auburn at the Iron Bowl. All of a sudden, when it comes down to head-to-head, all right, well, when they played each other, look what Henry was able to do. And that's going to put him ahead of him in that conversation. I agree with you that to some situations, no matter how good of a running back you are, you just can't run in certain situations.
But I do think that there's a little bit of a crack. I think Boykin throwing 4 picks and not being able to do anything last week was a big hurt. So you don't really, you know, the McCaffrey kid out in Stanford's not getting enough credit because he plays 4 hours after everybody's asleep. And so, you know, Dak has an opportunity if he plays well. You know, the Alabama game was really the game last year that took him out of the Heisman race. And it was really just one pick. If he doesn't try the back shoulder throw to Dorunya last year and get it picked in the end zone and has three touchdowns and two picks instead of two touchdowns and three picks, he probably, you know, is going to be a finalist or might even win the sucker. So, you know, it could definitely vault him into maybe a trip to the Heisman finalist.
That's kind of where I went with that. It wasn't anything against Fournette.
Nah. I wasn't attacking you, Kentucky.
I know you weren't.
Right on.
I think Fournette probably went from, if he'd gone for 120 yards, even the loss against Alabama.
Oh, yeah, he would have won it, yeah.
Yeah, I think now, you know, where if he'd done that, all he needed to do, in air quotes, is get 100 yards every game the rest of the year. Whereas now I think he's got a, you know, the first, what, 3-4 games of the season were just unreal. He's getting 200 yards every time you turn around. He's ripping off a 60-yard carry. I think he's got to have a game or maybe even two games like that down the stretch here where everyone remembers, oh, yeah, he's really freaking good. Like, he's kind of in that space where he can't just have 140 yards and two touchdowns. Like, that's not even good enough because he's kind of in the hole. But I totally agree. I mean, he's still the best running back in college football.
Yeah.
He just, sometimes as a running back, there's not anything you can do about a really good defense.
Let's see, and the thing about it is, the thing that we've got to look at is the one thing that kind of hurts Alabama and Derrick Henry, they're Penn State, then they get like this nobody, and then they're playing Auburn, who's really, you know, kind of fell off the map. You know, they've got Arkansas, they got Ole Miss, and then they've got Texas A&M. So he's got three pretty good, you know, games where, you know, if he hits 150, 200 yards in two out of those three games, and Alabama runs the table and then wins the SEC, you know, I think a lot of voters go, he's pretty damn good, except for the one time he played Alabama where they are just freaking machines.
Yeah, and
that was a dominating performance, man.
I was getting ready to say the same thing about what LSU schedule was like, so thank you for doing that. There's still, you know, even though there's 3 weeks, there's still a lot of football left to play.
We could call Cole right quick and let him know that if State wins and Arkansas wins, they're back in controlling their destiny at Ole Miss. So, not a lot of likelihood that's going to happen.
We didn't really talk about LSU-Arkansas. I mean, after what happened to LSU and what happened to Arkansas, I mean, I'm probably still picking LSU there, but don't you feel like that's certainly a spot where Arkansas can sneak out a win?
Well, I think they could sneak out. I think they could sneak out a win, but it's about magic. I mean, you come off of four overtimes, you come off of a crazy 4th-and-25 overtime win. You know, at some point, some of this magic runs out. Now, I said that about Auburn in the past, and that it didn't seem to happen to them at times. You know, they just kept finding ways to find more magic. So, I mean, it's always possible. But, you know, at some point, you know, when you face a good team like LSU, I think there's as good a chance as any that LSU's going to come back with some revenge and something to prove.
Yeah, I think LSU's defense is getting – I think they're getting tested this week, all this week. And I think offensively they're going to be able to move the ball against Arkansas's front. I think Fournette's going to be able to run. It's nothing like Bama. And so I think they kind of pick up with it, especially being in Death Valley. You know, I just think that LSU is going to kind of reset, and I think they're actually going to pretty much dominate it. I hope they do dominate. I hope they hurt a lot of Arkansas players so that we'll actually have a shot in Arkansas the next week.
The real reason.
So, yeah.
I don't think – do we need to talk about some of the other matchups? WCU at A&M?
No. Yeah. I mean, who knows, though? With A&M, they could – I don't even know. They might lose that game.
Shane, what's the over-under at Kentucky-Vanderbilt?
5.
34?
5.
40. 40 is the over-under, and Bama is a three-point favorite.
First one to nine wins.
Yeah.
40 is generous.
Yeah.
I think it's like under 37.
I've got 39.5 here, so.
Okay, yeah. I think do you know how ridiculous that is? That's actually a betting line?
In college football, yeah.
I mean, it's phenomenal. Anyway.
BYU at Mizzou. We're not going to really talk about that game, but, you know, did you guys read OutKick, the coverage, the nice article they did on this Missouri fiasco? Did you guys
get that? Yeah, it was – it's very interesting, Shane, and, you know, it's – I mean, I've read all different types of articles on it, and, you know, I don't know. It comes back to we are living in the least offensive time in our history, and everybody is exceedingly offended by everything, right? And so
– and quick to so act. Well, so, and quick to act.
Right, yeah, and so, and this is that was an example of the whole kind of social media mob, you know, mentality where, you know, kind of goes after it. And Clay Travis has a platform where he wants to go against the grain, and that's what kind of sells for him. And so, you know, it's a great article what he actually talked about. I do think that there's underlying things at Missouri that were happening, which, you know, you had a three-year president there before this guy that was a business guy, ex-CEO of Sprint, that was kind of a tumultuous tenure. And then they went and hired this guy who basically was not employed. He's out of the IT world, and he was a business guy that had Columbia backgrounds but had no academic, you know, understanding. And so it was 4 years of faculty, you know, not really trusting the process and – you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I don't think firing a president solves, you know, if, you know, a random dude screams racist comments. I mean, it seemed like it was a ton of isolated incidents that really firing a president really isn't going to change those. It's not a systematic thing. But I do think there's some respect. I think he didn't understand how an academic world worked. And Nick could probably, you know, talk to this a little bit more, being, you know, closer into that world. I mean, I'm 15 years, you know, behind that. But it's one of those things where I just got a feeling that the guy didn't understand that when you're in that role, you need, whether how ridiculous anything is, you actually have to show some type of respect and understanding and, you know, somewhat of attention to it. And not understand that things can actually fester and go up. But, yeah, but now when you're seeing all the reports that come out and that, you know, that possibly, you know, especially the tweets that the people made last night or two nights ago with the KKK being on campus and that there were you know, basically endangerment on campus that were completely inaccurate and false statements, didn't help a lot of the credibility, so...
Well, and the guy, and that's coming from the guy that did the hunger strike too, right?
Yeah,
and he's the same.
Yeah, whose family's worth like $20 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, and really the funny thing, I mean, I don't know if y'all got this, but I'm kind of a layman when it comes to like trying to figure out this stuff. But I was sitting there going, okay, so these people used the media to get this guy fired, and now they won't allow the media to cover them winning it, like, and their journalism school. I'm like, I'm confused. This is like, what's going on in Missouri? But well, it's a good thing that's in the South. It's so horrible down here with race relations.
Oh man,
Missouri. I mean, Missouri's like just a big. I mean, they got some serious issues going on.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the interesting things to me, and not that, you know, obviously the football team kind of played a major role in it, and you can read into what you want, but this is just a stat that a lot of people have thrown out there, and or a fact, it's, you know, whatever, I guess it's not a stat technically, but, you know, so this Missouri BYU game is at Arrowhead, and you guys know how those work. It's a equal payout. It's kind of like the beginning of the year. It's an equal payout for each team. You know, they got BYU to come out there and play, and I think each team's going to get about over $1 million. So if Missouri was to cancel their game, they're going to lose $1 million and a lot of prestige, a lot of credibility. And, you know, the president's buyout was only $500,000. And I'm not saying that that's – I mean, obviously the football team was a lot of leverage, but there's a lot of things that, you know, the national media hasn't even investigated about, because the football team, there's a – not to – you know, if there is, and we know that there are some racial issues there, this is a totally different story. But the fact that, you know, 32 or whatever – you know, players were able to rally the quote-unquote whole team to support this. And the strange thing was, sure, the rally or whatever, uprising, you know, got what they wanted, got a resignation out of the president, but it was just so strange how the football team went from, you know, 12 hours from, no, we're not playing the game, Gary Pinkel supporting everybody, to now, well, it's back on. You know, it's all fine.
Yeah.
Everything's fine. You know, we're going to practice today. And it was... You know, they have Mondays off already, so the only day that they technically didn't have football was the day that they were off anyway. So, not to say that, and that could have been a completely different coincidence, but it was they leveraged the power of the football team, and the football team had major implications on the line in not being able to play, and everything's solved by the next day. So, I don't know. It's just interesting to look at that, and that's being lost, and it should be in the fact that, you know, racial relations is much bigger than any game. But
but the other thing that I take from it is, really, they were fighting because really the climate was not very inclusive. Is the kind of the mantra, the theme that kept in there. But they actually, the student body voted for a black gay student body president. How inclusive can you get? I mean that speaks to me that here's, and you have an actual community and a university that was unanimously supportive of Michael Sam. And so that's where the kind of disconnect that I had was, you know, it's kind of weird. It's, you know, how does this guy get elected and with a student body, and then there's just overt racism out there? You know, but it is interesting that nobody knew anything about this until a 4-5 football team on Saturday night, of all places, in the middle of college football games going on, posted that tweet, and basically national writers said, hey, look what's going on in Missouri. And then really Sunday is when it kind of blew up. But you're right. I mean, you know, they were going to lose $1 million and have to pay the buyout. So that football game was going to be played.
Yeah. No, I think the truth, Clay Travis, in the article, you know, he was the first one to jump on this. I don't know if that was the truth or not. I don't have a timeline of what reporter put something out there first. But, you know, I do think that the truth lies somewhere in between what Clay's put out there and what the reports were from the media. I don't think that, you know, I think Clay said, you know, if you give me $20 million, I'll be any color you want me to be. referring to the guy who was on the hunger strike, you know, because that's what they're estimating, I think, his net worth to be. And so, you know, did he truly believe in some injustice for the healthcare? Maybe he did. I don't know how he thinks. But for him to then go off the handle and start saying that the KKK is on the campus when the Missouri Police Department has to come in and say, wait a minute, we've not seen any reports on this.
You know it's bad when the actual official Twitter handle for the school has to basically correct you.
Yeah, so I mean, the truth is going to lie somewhere in between, but what's happened is everything is so reactionary. It's not, let's walk through this and think through this logically and find out, get to the bottom of this and understand the situation. And I don't know which one of you said it, it's the mob mentality's taken force, and it's happened through social media. And this is just one example over a dozen different things that have occurred over the last, you know, year or so where social media has come to the forefront to take over. And we just need to get our wits about us and understand that you know, we all are on this earth. We all have these things that we need to do and we all want to accomplish. And sometimes we're not going to see eye to eye. And you know, it's not about black or white. It's about individuality and respecting those things. And we need to find a common ground because, you know, just because you have a Twitter handle doesn't mean you can come out and I mean, how many times do you see threats over Twitter about how, you know, I hope you die and jump off a cliff.
Yeah.
You know, let's be realistic. Would you say that to their face? No. Same things happened in that same situation, just got escalated through social media and this whole fiasco. It's I think it's going to end up looking more of a black eye on this whole situation in Missouri and Columbia than anything when the dust settles.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and it's all really stemming from the day that everything went down and their treatment of the media, because the media who was covering this story, I think, was a little bit kind of taken aback on why they were like, why are you treating the people that are actually telling your story? And I think that's kind of backfired on them. But, you know, you have the same situation, you know, which was originally handled in a poor way, but has actually led to a lot of change, is the whole Oklahoma deal with the frat song and Eric Stryker coming out with a profanity laden video vine. And then Stryker's actually gone and met with all the frat guys. And I saw this whole special on it where he's led people to have discussions over it and talking about how Oklahoma and that community is actually, they're actually having a conversation about it, even though the initial reaction was very hot and fiery. It's actually led to some good things. So hopefully that will for Missouri as well.
All right. Well, I hate ending on a downer note. So let's find some levity here. Does anybody have any
Kentucky football?
there's at least Boone Williams will be back. By all
intents, are they going to start Drew Barker?
I understand that Patrick's still going to be the guy, but I bet he's on a short leash and he's not had all the reps in practice. Yeah. Is the way I understand.
When he goes 3 for his first 11, they'll probably pull him.
No, he'll just match Vanderbilt. So
yeah.
So, no, that's, you know, the first to get 7 incompletions wins. It's like a game of horse.
That's right.
You know, we'll try to get together and do this next week. And so we will have some more riveting conversations to have. I want to thank Blair Smiley, Britton Burton, Nick Jones. Thank you guys for being on here. Appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy days, your busy work life, your family life to give us a little time to spread our SEC cheer to everyone. And we want to thank everyone for listening. We do it whether we know you are listening or not. So if you are listening, you know, let us know. We've got a couple of you that definitely let us know when we don't do something. But let us know if you're out there, what you think, what you don't like, what you like, and we'll try to do more of all of it. So, guys, with that, we will call this podcast done.